Welcome to Good Health, Better World, where we bring experts together to discuss issues that shape the health and well-being of our communities. Good Health, Better World is sponsored by UPMC Health Plan. I'm your host, Dr. Ellen Beckjord, and in this season, we'll focus on behavioral health and the mind-body connection at every stage of life. Let's dive in. In this episode of Good Health, Better World, we're going to talk about adolescent and pediatric behavioral health. I am very happy to have two wonderful guests with me today, Dr. Abigail Schlesinger, Clinical Chief of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Integrated Care for UPMC Western Psychiatric Hospital and Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, and Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, and Dr. Johanna Vidal-Phelan, Chief Medical Officer in the Quality Department at the UPMC Health Plan Insurance Services Division, and Clinical Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Dr. Schlesinger, welcome to Good Health, Better World.
Thank you.
Dr. Vidal-Phelan, welcome.
Thank you.
Children and teens can have behavioral health challenges that are different from those that adults experience. Dr. Vidal-Phelan, I hear your voice in my head all the time. Children and adolescents are not little adults. They are children and adolescents. So I'll start with you, Dr. Vidal-Phelan. Can you talk about some of the challenges that might be unique to these younger age groups? And then Dr. Schlesinger would love to hear your perspective as well.
Thank you so much, Ellen. And yes, children and teenagers are not literal adults, which means we can treat them like such. For example, children, to be able to express their emotions is challenging. So a young child saying, I'm depressed, I'm anxious, there are complex emotions and sentiments that are really difficult for children to communicate. And so as adults and as caregivers, it's really important that we recognize sometimes very subtle signs that do not present and probably as, quote, behavioral, but more physical health, as signs of stress, as signs of anxiety and depression. Children are also different, and teenagers different from adults, as that they depend on a parent or a caregiver to seek care. And so it's really important that we realize that unless we support the family as part of the entire behavioral world, is not something that we're going to be able to reach the children.
And I think that inclusion of the family is so important. It's come up in other discussions that we've had about children and adolescents, but it really increases the complexity of the landscape.
Absolutely. As a pediatrician myself, I'm not only treating the child in front of me, but his entire family. I'm educating the parents so that in the home environment, they can care for their child and be successful, empowering caregivers to provide this care in the home.
Dr. Schlesinger, what are some of your thoughts on some of the unique challenges that behavioral health can present to children and adolescents?
It starts with the family, and behavior starts as soon as a child is born. And it's easy for us to think about babies as needing their parents, right? Because they can't survive literally without their parents. But even adolescents need their parents. And as I often say, adolescents may not always appear like they're listening, but they're listening and they're watching everything we do. But to go back to childhood and children, young babies, it is important to remember that children have different goals than adults do, things they need to accomplish, right? Young children need to learn how to speak before they can tell you they're depressed or tell they're even happy, right? They start with smiles and learning how to go back and forth with their family. So again, going back to what the doctor said earlier, how important that family really is to help the child develop their sense of who they are, to help them feel secure. But also the family helps know who a child is if they're starting to experience new behaviors and whether that's like their child or whether it's a change that they're concerned about. And there's so many opportunities to change the trajectory, really to change the course for a child if you notice they're struggling in some way. And in the converse, if you notice there's a strength they have, there's a real opportunity to just have them take off in that area. So children are not little adults, thank goodness, right? That's why we love having them around most of the time. But then teens, I think, is something that we should tackle separately. So teens think they're little adults sometimes. And that's part of being a teenager. But it's also when a variety of risk factors for depression, anxiety begin to develop. As kids explore more, and they should explore, right? Kids should be taking risks. I'm sure many of us remember doing things that if our parents knew we did when we were younger, they might have been upset, right? But that's what kids do. They try new things. And the earlier you help them recognize their emotions, respond to their emotions, respond to those around them, the better off they'll be.
I'm just struck by how dynamic a time childhood and adolescence and even young adulthood is, how many milestones there are, just how much movement and growth there is, which certainly creates a lot of opportunity for influence. And also creates a lot of opportunity for, you know, specific and precise and strategic intervention. And so, Dr. Schlesinger, if I can stay with you, I'd like to talk about the effect that the pandemic has had on children and adolescents.
Yeah, I would gladly talk about that. And I guess I want to start with a caveat that what I'm going to say next isn't meant to scare anyone or meant to think that we have an entire generation of kids that are somehow going to be, quote, messed up. No, they had a different experience than I had as a child, than anyone listening to this podcast as an adult had an experience. And the more we're aware of the experience they had and how it might affect them, the better we can help, again, move them in the appropriate trajectory. And what I tell first is know your kid, spend time with your kid, talk to your friends and family about how they're doing, how you're doing, and go to a professional like your pediatrician if you're concerned. But it is true that kids are, it's a dynamic phase of life. In a couple years, a kid goes from having no words to having 50 to 100 to 1,000 words by the time they go to long before school. So really dynamic changes. And I like to use specific examples to describe how COVID's had an effect. So if you were to learn how to speak and you didn't have very many people to interact with because your parents were working, because lots of us were working in front of a computer all the time, and then at night trying to catch up and figure out what's going on and maybe scared, anxious, or depressed, that might impact the ability of the child to learn how to speak during that time. Or the ability of you to see that they're not speaking as much as their peers because you didn't have them around their peers as much. So a lot of families noticed as we came out of the pandemic, when they put their kids around other kids, they didn't, maybe if they had kids beforehand, they're like, they're not interacting the way my kids before did. Well, they don't because they didn't have the same experience. And it requires us to be, as parents, as not just parents, as members of this whole culture, more thoughtful about our children and more aware of what's going on with them. So we can see how are they doing? What strengths are they developing? Maybe they're developing new strengths because they learned how to do something on a computer they would have never seen. And then to jump ahead to those preteens. And we talk about teens all the time, but I really have been most impressed with the impact of the preteens. So think about the difference for yourself for when you were 10 or 11 and when you were 13 or 14. Big changes, social changes, emotional changes, friend groups change, and the social structure of school completely changed. So the pandemic has gone on over 2 years now, and some kids, especially in high-risk communities, sadly, had almost no school during that time. The place where they learned how to be people, the place where they learned how to interact in groups and their social skills. So if you take a kiddo and think about it for yourself, if you were 10 when the pandemic started in that March when they said, go home and don't come back, and now it's 2 years later or even a year later, and the whole sort of social structure has changed. Now, that may be easier for more social kids, right? Or more impulsive kids that just sort of bang in and just say, here I am. The anxious kids, those quiet kids, may be more confused by the signals and, again, need more help from a supportive parent. I talked to a lot of parents sort of last year and still this year about maybe thinking about things like play dates for preteens and teens. You don't have to call them play dates anymore, but that they might, it might be useful for you to plan some events with them to help scaffold them.
I really love using that word scaffolding. And I'll say personally with my 13-year-old daughter, I'm noticing two things. One, that I do have to scaffold some of those getting back into social interactions. And also, I am 100% still calling them play dates, which drives her crazy. And as you're talking, I'm wondering, I've always sort of thought that was maybe just a habit or maybe, you know, my reluctance at some subconscious level to allow her to, you know, emerge from childhood. But I'm wondering now if it's because back when she was doing a lot of socializing, they were still play dates. So we're all sort of delayed, right?
I noticed it with my son at the beach. We went out in the water and he didn't really understand undertow. And I was like, what do you mean? And I got scared. And then I realized he's so much further ahead physically than he was the last time he'd been at the beach. But as a parent, I'd never had to be around him at this stage. So yeah, we're all at a different place.
And that's a great point too, that just because these delays have happened in many instances, it's possible to catch up. Growth is possible. Recovery is possible. Intervention is possible.
And can I say, with kids, growth is definitely going to happen.
Yep.
It's just how we move it along. It's not just that they're going to get bigger and taller. They're going to change.
Dr. Vidal-Phelan, if I could ask for your perspective on some of the impact that COVID-19 has had on children and teens, and would love to hear, you know, your perspective from any angle, but especially as a pediatrician, as a practicing pediatrician. I'm also curious if you care to comment from your perspective as the chief medical officer of the quality department with respect to whether and how the pandemic has affected children being up to date on some of their preventive and routine medical care.
You know, as a pediatrician, you know, those months of isolation and not seeing our patients not only caused a lot of anxiety for families, but also for us as caregivers, because we are definitely want to keep our patients in a medical home and we want to be available. You know, at the start of the pandemic, one of the biggest challenges I saw with children and families is access to the information, in the right language. And we are definitely been working really hard with our team and our physicians and providers to really make those well-child visits and immunizations a priority. At the same time, we are fighting misinformation every day. And the amount of information that families and children are getting exposed in social media that is not correct is a concern. So really having the opportunities for families to come to our clinic, call us, do telemedicine visits, bring their questions and concerns about well-child visits and immunization is really important. And a message for families is that a well-child visit is not only about immunizations. A well-child visit, we are assessing the well-being of the family. We screen for social determinants of health. We screen for behavioral health concerns, especially like postpartum depression. For the teenagers, we're screening for depression and anxiety.
I appreciate that you mentioned telemedicine emerging as a new tool and would be interested in either of your perspectives on ways that we're perhaps better making use of telemedicine in behavioral healthcare for children and adolescents. So can appreciate that there was still a really vital role that face-to-face encounters with child and adolescent healthcare providers needed to be maintained even during the course of the pandemic, and what a challenge that must have been.
Absolutely. And telemedicine is a tool to outreach to our patients, to our community. And definitely it provides an open a door, an opportunity for certain things that we can do from a home environment. So, for example, a follow-up for ADHD visit could be done via telemedicine, or a follow-up for depression, anxiety. And also the families really appreciate the opportunity to have this contact with their pediatrician, their behavioral health specialist, their family doctor from a home environment.
Dr. Schlesinger, if I could ask you to stay on that theme of family, which is so important in child and adolescent physical and behavioral health. You know, children and adolescents, it seems like it's very, very difficult for them to be healthy and well if the adults in their life are not healthy and well and able to support their health and well-being. So can you talk about that? And in particular, I'm wondering if you think our care delivery system in physical or behavioral health, is really set up to accommodate that need to have a family focus or a family level of intervention when it comes to healthcare for children and adolescents.
I think we strive for it. I think we all strive for it. But let's be clear, the funding systems aren't necessarily set up to drive those sort of choices. Our world isn't really set up to drive those sort of choices in the healthcare landscape. You know, we've done telehealth for a long time, actually. It didn't just start in the pandemic. But the massive shift of the number of providers that went to telehealth in March and April of 2020, many people got care because of the way our pediatricians and primary care doctors stepped up. So many people got care that wouldn't have if it wasn't for our primary care doctor. I can't say enough about that. And what I've seen throughout the pandemic is our primary care physicians continuing to say, well, how can we keep doing this? Because this is the right thing for our families and kids we see. Same for my behavioral health providers. How can we keep doing this? I hear to this day people saying, you know, what can we do to help keep this available for kids and families? What can we do to expand internet so every kid and family can have this? And I was also impressed and continue to be that we had two populations that may not always resonate as being similar to each other, both be at the same deficit when it came to the telehealth infrastructure. I see kids from the inner city and I see kids from rural areas, and they each had the same problem. They didn't have good Wi-Fi. And it became apparent that everyone needs good Wi-Fi because that's going to be vital as we move forward for people to everyone have the same access to care.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm old enough, I should say, to remember when people started talking about the digital divide. Really primarily now it seems to be about who has sufficient bandwidth, who has broadband access and who doesn't, to do something like a synchronous video visit. And we cannot forget about that level of inequity that affects the potential of telemedicine to help solve for some health disparities and health inequities. So I appreciate that you brought that up. I think that's a really important point to make. Dr. Vidal-Phelan.
Thank you so much. I have to share an amazing story as a pediatrician during the beginning of the pandemic. As many of us, I haven't used telemedicine until the pandemic started and quickly shifted to doing telemedicine visits, that first year post-pandemic. And it transforms me because of the feedback that I received from the patients. That telemedicine appointment, many of them was done in Spanish, as I am a bilingual, and the families were experiencing access to services in their own language from a home environment. They were so grateful, and the impact. I was able to, for example, during the telemedicine visits, ask which medications your child is taking, and mom be like, wait a minute, let me go to the kitchen cabinet and open it and show me the bottle. Oh, that's the green button. That's Zyrtec. So it's really very powerful how to use technology matched with language access and really addressing the needs of vulnerable communities during the pandemic.
I think it's really hard to probably overestimate how important almost all of the latent benefits of telemedicine that you're mentioning, whether it be allowing people to receive healthcare in an environment that feels comfortable to them, for people when they're outside of their home environment, when that's a real challenge, or not having to burden people with long transportation or long rides to get to the healthcare provider. When Dr. Kimberly Blair was here and we talked about trauma-informed care and trauma-informed systems of care, she gave us lots of wonderful perspective from the child and adolescent vantage point. And she talked about the systems that children and adolescents are embedded in that are different from systems that adults are embedded in. And the two systems that she talked about were the family system and the school system. And I'm wondering if either of you or both of you would care to comment on how those systems are instrumental to adolescent and pediatric behavioral health.
Oh, I have so many thoughts about this. So I'd like to expand the family system to include maybe kin, K-I-N, or the sort of whole social environment someone's people are in. So whatever that system is around you that's outside of school. Those systems are vital. And let's be clear, in COVID, each and every one of those systems were altered, so many at once. And they continue to be altered in ways that are we need to be aware of for our children. So in terms of families, we can't forget that many children in the United States lost their primary caregiver in the COVID pandemic. And I think within all of the information, misinformation, discussion, downright screaming about COVID, we sometimes forget that every time you bring up COVID, there's going to be a lot of kids that are going to have a trauma reaction to that because they lost either a parent or a grandparent. If your family was lucky enough to not lose their job during the pandemic, they were still stressed on a regular basis. And stress takes time away from being a parent. And as we all know, it's a lot of work to be a parent. So when those systems get stressed, it's harder on children. Now, luckily, children are resilient. And they'll do things to get your attention when you're stressed about that. So we saw some more behavior problems too, right? I had family members come in and said, I never realized my kid was this active. And you had to say, like, well, we have to think, were they really this active? Or are they trying to get you to see, hey, look at me. Get off that phone, get off that computer, look at me. So, you know, as I'm going to say later, behavior is an opportunity for kids to express themselves to us. And no question that the family and social environment was impaired during the pandemic. And hopefully there'll be continued focus on how we rebuild those support systems through people, not just through medical specialties, but through our communities. And then the schools. I think lots of people just think school's about learning to read, write, you know, and arithmetic, as they say. When I think about school, I think about social relationships. I think about incredible teachers whose job is to help a child figure out who they are and help figure out what each kid's needs are. And as a parent, there's no way I could know what my kid looks like in front of every kid in the class. I mean, I'm a child psychiatrist. I've probably seen thousands of kids. I still can't do it. This is a teacher's thing. And our kids didn't see teachers for an entire year, some of them a year and a half. And then when the teachers came back, they came back to a world that was nothing like what they were used to. What are the long-term impacts? Like, how much support do we need to keep giving the teachers and the school as we move forward? And we really need to be thinking about them, all the helpers, quite frankly, but the teachers, you can't get lost in this because they are an essential support for our kiddos in every way.
Absolutely. Such a critical source of support and such critical surveillance, as you mentioned, eyes on those kids and in a way and from a perspective that is different from anybody else in their life. And what challenging trade-offs must have been made around the decision to close schools to address transmission of COVID against knowing what that was going to mean for kids who then were going to lose that whole system of support and surveillance and intervention for whatever length of time. Dr. Vidal Phelan, did you want to add to any of those thoughts about family or kin systems, community systems, or school systems?
Yes. I mean, one of the things I really admire, even during our prep call and today, is your view on behavioral concerns from children and the different perspective as an opportunity, as they're trying to express themselves. And that is so true. And children have different talents and different needs. And as parents, caregivers, and community around children, we need to listen to that. Because when a child is supported, when a child has the resources, that child will thrive. And that's what we want. We want children to have a future, to reach their full potential. And sometimes that means that we need to talk to the pediatrician about, you know, I have some concerns about behavior. Maybe that means having a call with the teacher in the school, because teachers are essential in noticing behaviors that and feedback that is really important to us on a better understanding. I also want to point out that the pandemic disproportionately impacted vulnerable communities and children that comes from communities of colors, our Black children, our Latino children. Their experience academically is very different from the experience that my children have, for example. When my children left school because of the pandemic, I quickly figured out a website to do math. I quickly was teaching things. I quickly was a highly already engaged. I speak English, so that means that I have access to information. And I was humbled to see how parents would come to the pediatric office and say, I don't even know what's happening in the school. So the lifelong impact of children technically missing almost a year of school is something that is felt differently in communities of color. So we want to come along these communities and we want to support them and we want to encourage them and we want to provide resources because all children deserve the opportunities to, again, reach their full potential. And it has been a challenge.
As we've talked about children and adolescents, partly because of the expected lifespan they have ahead of them, and I think also partly because of that dynamic nature of that time in life when intervention can have such a meaningful impact. Not that intervention at any phase of life can't have an impact, but just that leverage point, given the dynamic nature of those milestones in childhood and adolescence, such an investment that we make when we invest in our children.
And such a complicated investment, right? Because the payoff may be a decade to 20 to 40 years later. We often hear, what's the return on investment? What are you going to get? And unfortunately, you know, we as humans aren't smart enough yet to figure out how to calculate that 10, 20 year payoff. We have to understand what's going on here and believe that by investing in young children, investing in teenagers, that it will make a difference because the dollar signs won't always prove it.
And I think when there is a time lag between the investment and the return, which is true in lots of cases, it becomes easy for people to say not it. Like, well, then who's going to make the investment, right? If there's a time lag between the investment and the return, it becomes less clear who's going to realize the return. But this is just the right thing to do. I mean, this is something that I've heard our CEO at UPMC Health Plan, Diane Holder, talk about, the importance of making investment in children and in families because it's the right thing to do and it will pay off.
You know, we're in the healthcare industry. We're all figured out together and things were changing so quickly, but it really reflects of what you just said earlier. Teenagers, children are looking at us. You can tell them, don't do this, but if you're doing it, they're going to see what you're doing and follow that. And also as parents, we need to exemplify to them, we care for ourselves too. So we care for them, but in order for them to learn good behavior, they need to know that I am taking care of myself. I am eating healthy. I am exercising. I'm doing all these behaviors to have a healthy life, which I want to pass on to you. So I think, you know, when we think about children and you say earlier the ROI, when you give healthy food to children, clean water, a stable housing, good and affordable education, they thrive. And they are reaching their full potential, well-adjusted adults, no? And so our goal, and if anybody listening understands, being a parent is hard, you know, but it is an investment. So if your child is showing signs of stress, if you have concerns, stop what you're doing, get help. Call your pediatrician, call your therapist, call your psychiatrist.
So often I think we're more likely to help others than we are to help ourselves. But I think parents are often motivated to be the best they can be for their children.
I think it's one of the main reasons many people get help that are parents. I certainly see that in my practice. And, you know, this just reminds me the other vulnerable group coming out of the COVID pandemic is the helper group. Right. So any group that defines themselves as a helping group is vulnerable. Doctors, nurses, frontline health workers, mothers,
teachers.
I often like to remind people, think about it. Like, in what way are you a part of that helping group? And are you doing everything you need to do for you so you can help your children? Because we know, and then we need to really reach out as a society to help them.
Yep, absolutely. Well, one last question that I'd like to ask both of you, and perhaps Dr. Vidal-Phelan, we can start with you, and then Dr. Schlesinger would love to hear your perspective too. What would you like to see for the future of pediatric and adolescent behavioral health, knowing that there are any number of answers you might give to that question, but if you had to prioritize one, Dr. Vidal-Phelan, what is something that you would really prioritize to bring about the change or the transformation or the potential, you know, is possible in pediatric and adolescent behavioral health?
I would say integration of your behavioral, emotional, spiritual health as part of healthcare in general, no? And working alongside behavioral health providers together to have that holistic view of my patient, our families together. I think there's a lot of division between physical health and behavioral health, and we know that that is interconnected. One cannot be well without the other. And so really, I want to think about integration of the destigmatizing behavioral health. You know, just like I get a BMI in the practice, which is body mass index, I want to talk about behavioral health. I want to talk about the well-being of the family, because many times when that is not in the right place, all the other things that I want to do, like nutrition and exercise counseling and anticipatory guidance, is not heard. I think the other one for me, I really would like to see access of behavioral health services that are multilingual, multicultural. Many times the challenge is I'm working with a family who speaks Spanish, for example, and to get services from a therapist or a psychiatrist that not only speaks Spanish, but understand the culture and can really put it in that context.
Thank you. Dr. Schlesinger, how about you?
Well, I love what you said and totally resonate with the need to combine physical health and mental health and see it all as one, the whole person, as they say. But I think I'd like to focus on when we see children and how they're doing, that I'd like us to get to a point where when a child has a behavior that's maybe different, that we don't see it as a problem necessarily to be fixed, but as an opportunity to see what are they trying to tell us? What are the next steps? So let's be clear. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist. I make diagnoses, I prescribe medicine, I prescribe service help, and I help families figure out what the problems are. But I think people would be a lot less scared to come see me or a therapist, and we'd be able to work a lot better together if when we looked at kids, when we talked about how people were doing, we really see every behavior as an opportunity to help that child.
Oh, I love that answer. Thinking about behavior as communication and problem solving, not calling things problems, but if there's problem solving to be done, working together to figure out how to help children and adolescents and families really realize their full potential and quality of life that they're seeking to achieve, that all of us deserve. Well, Dr. Schlesinger, Dr. Vidal-Phelan, I want to thank you both so much for being guests on Good Health, Better World. I have such respect and admiration for helpers, especially those who help children and adolescents. So I want to also thank you for the work that you do, that you've done over the course of the pandemic, and the way that you both champion children and adolescents. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Good Health, Better World, presented by UPMC Health Plan. Be sure to check the episode show notes for information and resources related to behavioral health. We hope you tune in next time for more support and insight.